Right, thank you, everyone, for joining us this evening at InfidelGuy.com for this special feature presentation. It is a debate between Dan Barker. Many of you know of Dan Barker as a former minister, now atheist. You can check out his website at Freedom From Religion. What's called Freedom From Religion, and it's ffrf.org. And also, we have with us Paul Manata. Many of you have heard Paul Manata on Gene Cook's programs over at Unchained Radio. And Paul Manata's blog is at presstheantithesis.blogspot.com. So you can check out that. You can also simply do a Google search, and you'll have results as well for both of our debaters this evening. Now, the issue to resolve tonight is, which is more rational, Christian theism or atheism? So that will be the issue to resolve. So we'll see what happens here. The format, the debate format, is as such. Paul is going to open, of course, with the affirmative, and then Dan is going to, Dan is going to open as well. And you know, 2 minutes, 10 minutes each side, so 20 minutes total. And then, of course, Paul will cross, Dan will cross, and we'll continue to do that, 20 minutes each side, and then 10 minutes for closing, and then 20 minutes for, questions from the audience. I know that a lot of you want an opportunity to talk to both Dan and Paul, so I'm going to give you guys plenty of time to do that. So please hold off on all of your questions. Please wait until around 8:40. I'll let you guys know, but go ahead and write your questions out. About 8:40, feel free to type those in red in my chat rooms. I have video cam open right now and stick cam, and also the IRC room is up and running as well. And type those questions in red at 8:40, and I will then ask those questions. Well, whoever you direct it to, both people will still get an opportunity to address those questions. So, without further ado, I guess we'll begin here. Thank you very much, Paul and Dan, for appearing on the Infidel Guy for this debate tonight.
Thanks for inviting us.
All right, well, Paul, open. You have 10 minutes.
Okay, first I'd like to say, by way of introduction, that I'm very grateful to Mr. Finley for hosting and moderating this debate. And I'd also like to thank all of those listening for giving up their time to listen to what I consider to be an important topic. I'd like to take this opportunity also to thank Dan Barker for taking time out of his busy schedule to engage me on this topic. Especially thank my wife and my son for giving up time together so I could prepare for this debate. And finally, and most importantly, I'd like to thank my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, the Lord and exemplar of rationality. The resolution of tonight's debate is, which is more rational, Christian theism or atheism? My answer will not be that Christianity is simply more rational than atheism. This might strike you as odd, since that's what the debate is about. The question seems to imply that Christianity and atheism could both be rational, just one more than the other. But this position dishonors my Lord and is contrary to my worldview. The Bible claims that it is the fool who says there's no God. Certainly such a position, given my worldview, is not rational. Therefore, my answer will be that atheism is not rational at all, and the Christian position is the only truly rational position. Finally, before answering this question, it's first necessary that I define some terms. And since I'm a representative of Christianity here, I'll need to define what I mean when I speak of Christianity. Very simply, what I mean to defend when I speak of Christian theism is that system of thought which is very nicely summarized in the Reformed creeds and confessions. This is what I take to be biblical Christianity. Thus, any attempts by Mr. Barker to show that Christianity is irrational because of, say, libertarian views of the will be to attack strawmen. Now, Mr. Barker is in the same position, and that's why I'll let him define atheism for us. It should be noted that there are different conceptions of atheism and what that word means. For example, in a blog article, atheist Jeffrey J. Louder writes, quote, "The atheist movement keeps shooting itself in the foot by failing to reach a consensus regarding the meaning of atheism," unquote. Lastly, we should define rationality. What do we mean by rational? This is not as clear as it would seem. For example, Blackwell's Companion to Epistemology lists no less than 9 different conceptions or meanings of what might be meant by rationality. We can see very quickly how this is the case. I think most people would agree that a rough and ready idea of rationality are beliefs or agents that are formed or guided by legitimate reasoning. But different types of legitimacy are considered appropriate for different types of reasoning. Thus, what is legitimate for correct mathematical reasoning is different than what is legitimate for inductive reasoning or, say, means-end views of rationality. In some cases, what people mean by rational are those beliefs which come from what philosophers refer to as the deliverances of reason. For example, the claim that all bachelors are unmarried is a deliverance of reason because it is self-evident in the sense that once you understand the definition of bachelor, you understand the truth of that proposition. It's true by logical structure. Neither Christianity or atheism seem to be rational in this way, though. Well, I do agree that there are certain paradigms of rationality. Logic, induction, making proper ethical decisions, etc., are all rational things. I think Mr. Barker would agree. At this point, then, we must move beyond the surface and look into which worldview can give an account for these rational practices. This should be obvious, and I'll offer just two reasons for it. One, if the truth of one's worldview undermines any of the above paradigms, then one cannot consistently appeal to them to defeat my worldview. Two, since I deny Mr. Barker's presuppositions and he denies mine, then he cannot use his as a standard to determine that mine are rational. That is to say, assuming that his view and his position is rational and valid and appropriate is simply to beg the question of the debate tonight. And if those reasons were not enough, Mr. Barker himself admits that the debate must be at the level of presupposition. On page 62 of Losing Faith in Faith, Mr. Barker makes the claim twice that debate, to be effective, must be made at, quote, the level of assumption, unquote, and that we should, quote, examine the presuppositional underpinnings, unquote. On page 83 of the same book, Mr. Barker tells us that, quote, epistemology should be addressed before biblical criticism, unquote. And this is what I intend to do. Likewise, Mr. Barker needs to present an epistemology from which he can attack my worldview. So if we cannot assume our presuppositions to attack the others, since that would be begging the question, then how should we seek to undermine our opposition? The only valid line of attack, when ultimate authority is on the line, is to attack the position on its own internal merit. This is known by philosophers as an internal critique. Indeed, on page 53 of Losing Faith in Faith, Mr. Barker recognizes that, quote, all arguments should be weighed for their own sake, based on their own evidences and logical consistencies, unquote. Thus, I shall argue that even granting Mr. Barker's own presuppositions for argument's sake, his worldview is internally inconsistent. Interestingly, this line of objection isn't even available for Mr. Barker. Indeed, on page 60 of Losing Faith in Faith, Mr. Barker concedes that granting the Christian's presuppositions, granting our position, Christianity is internally consistent. He says if our presuppositions are assumed, then our position is logical, granting our position. On the other hand, I maintain that if his positions are assumed, then the paradigms of rationality are undermined. A couple of brief examples of internal problems with Mr. Barker's worldview is when he claims, quote, the scientific method is the only trustworthy way of obtaining knowledge, unquote. Page 133, Losing Faith in Faith. The problem here should be obvious once one asks Mr. Barker how he knows this claim. Not only is it an epistemological presupposition, it's obviously not known by the scientific method. Thus, Mr. Barker's criterion for knowledge, if correct, does not satisfy its own criteria. Secondly, on page 67 of Losing Faith in Faith, Mr. Barker says that the atheist limits himself to the facts which are, quote, observable, testable, and verifiable, unquote. The problem is that this fact is not observable, testable, or verifiable. Neither are the facts of logic, morality, induction. Therefore, I maintain that not only is my worldview internally consistent and Mr. Barker's is not, but mine allows for and does not undermine the paradigms of rationality spoken of earlier. Indeed, my worldview provides the very ontological and epistemological presuppositions required for those paradigms of rationality, logic, science, and morality to be made intelligible. In my worldview, immaterial, invariant, and normative laws of logic are not automatically problematic. In my worldview, the existence of God and the doctrine of his counsel as controlling all things in the universe is the presupposition which accounts for the uniformity of nature. In my worldview, normative and objective standards of ethics are intelligible because they reflect God's righteous character, whereas in Mr. Barker's worldview, right and wrong are decided by our thinking, page 13 in his book, Maybe Right, Maybe Wrong, but simultaneously admits that, quote, there is something about human nature which makes most of us susceptible to error, unquote, page 121 of Losing Faith in Faith. Mr. Barker needs to provide a worldview that is internally consistent and does not undermine rationality in order to engage in this debate. This should be obvious since we're debating worldviews. And Mr. Barker has told us on pages 99 and 100 of Losing Faith in Faith that, quote, atheism offers no particular philosophy, no values, betrays nothing of morality or motives. Atheism is no guarantee of kindness, morality, fairness, happiness, or even rationality. Because atheism has nothing to offer and nothing to prove, unquote. At this juncture, it appears that atheism is, according to Dan, at best, non-rational. Therefore, there is no way Dan can prove that atheism is more rational than Christianity. Indeed, since rationality applies either to beliefs or agents, and Mr. Barker has told us that atheism is not a belief on page 99 of Losing Faith in Faith, then rationality cannot be applied to the belief of atheism since there is no belief there. Thus, we see that Mr. Barker has a burden as well. He cannot leave it that atheism is non-rational since non-rational can't be rational. If Mr. Barker wants to show that my worldview is irrational, he must first provide us with a worldview that establishes rather than undermines the paradigms of rationality already mentioned. However, I've already demonstrated that his views of reason and knowledge undermine themselves. In summary, I'm arguing that 1, Mr. Barker's worldview undermines the possibility of rationality, 2, can only be, at best, non-rational, and 3, has admittedly relinquished any ability to even offer a critique of Christianity. Christian theism alone provides the necessary preconditions of intelligibility, and thus I maintain that Mr. Barker's rejection of Christianity leaves him unable to account for logic, induction, or ethics, and therefore without an apologetic tonight. Thank you.
All right, a very good time. Thank you very much, Paul. Appreciate that. Okay, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, if there are people you know of who are having difficulty listening to the feed, please go ahead and try Gene's feed at unchainedradio.com. There's port 8000/listen.pls. You can also find the link at infidelguide.com right now as well, at the top left or top middle of the web page. All right, so, Dan, please go ahead. You have 10 minutes.
Hi, thanks, Reggie, and thank you, Paul. I'm glad you read so much of my book. Looks like you've been learning some things, Paul. If you write a book, I'd be happy to read yours as well. I understand that Paul was once a character in a musical that I wrote back in the 70s. A donkey or a horse or something. So, and you know, I think it was great music. It was a lot of fun. The concepts are quite silly. This whole idea that you have to sacrifice an animal in order to pay for sins, which is in the Bible, is similar to previous pagan mythologies of bloodletting and violence and killing in order to appease the wrath of the whoever was in charge, the king or the ruler. But I still like the music of those musicals, and I'm actually still getting royalties from them, which is a lot of fun. Christianity is not reasonable. It is not rational. You cannot make something rational by simply asserting that you can presuppose that your selected worldview is, by fiat, rational. I could do that with the worldview of my Native American ancestors, that some ducks were swimming on the water in the beginning, and one of the ducks swam down below the water and found some dirt and brought it up to the surface, and another duck then spit on it, and it made the continents, and it separated the waters, and therefore these ducks were the creator. I mean, I could presuppose that. I could presuppose that document and that myth, and we are created in the images of these ducks who were intelligent. Simply presupposing something to be true might be internally consistent. You can make all sorts of internally consistent arguments by presupposing anything, but that doesn't make it actually true. The only way we have ever found for something to be true is to check it out. So what does the word true mean? Truth is not a thing. Logic is not a thing. Morality is not a thing. Ethics is not a thing. Value is not a thing. It doesn't need a source. What they are functions of a brain or some type of thinking organism. A value is not something that you go out and find somewhere. We make a computational function within a brain of whether or not this item has value to us for survival reasons or reproductive reasons or pleasurable or whatever reasons. It is a mistake of many believers to assume that because we have a word for something that therefore that thing must exist. You can presuppose it exists, I suppose, but the only way that we human beings have found to verify the truth value of a statement is by checking it out. By truth, we don't mean a thing with a capital T. By truth, I mean the degree with which a statement corresponds with reality. The only thing that can be true or false is a statement. You can't have a true table. You can say that table is good, and that's true, but you can't have a truth is not a thing out there that's a quality that applies to anything except a statement or a proposition. And the only way a proposition can be veridical, which means it can be true or false, is that that statement must contain at least one reference to reality within it. If I were to say all bluebirds are quicklebops, and then I would presuppose that that's true, you would say, well, what are you talking about? You need to have one of those statements has to be rooted somehow in the world. You have to be able to say so we can check it out. So when you make a statement that has some reference, at least one reference to the real world, and you make some kind of either a value or a declarative statement about it, then you can check that statement out to see whether or not it corresponds. Some people don't think that correspondence admits of degrees or that truth doesn't admit of degrees. I don't know, but in any event, whether it corresponds or not is what we would call truth. And in most cases, truth is not absolute. If I say the sky is blue, most of you would say, well, okay, yeah, but it's actually blue only about 40% of the time. But we still understand that there's truth value to that statement. Even though we don't have 100% confidence in it, we can say that statement is a true statement. So atheism is the only rational, logical outcome of applying to the question of whether or not there's a God. Atheism is not a worldview on anything else. Atheism is not a political or moral or social worldview. Christianity pretends to be, but atheism, in one sense, like Paul quoted from my book, atheism is simply the absence of a belief in a God. Atheism is not a belief, and Jeff Lauder is right that there are differences of opinion among atheists, but he's wrong that this is a big problem, because atheists welcome and cherish the differences of opinion. I admit that I am both a lowercase atheist, which is the absence of belief in a God or gods in general, but at the same time, I am also an uppercase atheist with a capital A, a hard atheist. If you ask me about a particular God or gods, for example, when it comes to the God of the Bible, I am an uppercase atheist. I not only don't have a belief in that God, I claim to believe and know that that God does not exist for one of the very reasons that Paul gave, in that you can't have a married bachelor by definition. I'll give you just one brief example, but there are about a dozen that come to my mind. One example is omniscience and omnipotence. If there's a personal being who knows the future, who's all-powerful, and I'm omniscient, then that being knows its own future actions. That being knows what it's going to do tomorrow at 12 noon, and by knowing that, is unable to change that. That being's future is fixed. That being, there are limits put on what that being can do, because that being today, being omniscient, can't change what it knows it's going to do tomorrow at 12 noon. So that being cannot be a personal being. To be a personal being, you have to have options. You have to be able to make decisions. A being who is omniscient and personal cannot exist. It's like a married bachelor existing. If God goes ahead and changes his mind anyway to show how powerful he is, well, then he wasn't omniscient in the first place. And what you have is a being who's not personal, as Christians define God to be a personal being. You have something like a robot or a computer program or whatever. So that particular God, this doesn't disprove all gods, but this argument disproves that particular God with those particular characteristics. And I can say I am a positive, hard, capital A atheist in regards to that God. But in general, atheism is simply the absence of a belief in a God. Why do I not have a belief in a God? Because there's no evidence. There's no good argument for the God. There's no need for a God. We can live perfectly good, happy, moral, productive, joyful, meaningful lives without a God. Many of us do. Lives that are more happy, more meaningful, more joyful, more ethical than the lives of most Christians in the world, if you measure by any standard. And we don't base it on the image of a God whom we see in the Bible to be the antithesis of morality. His actions are so disrespectful of life. So, there's no coherent definition of a God. Logic and morality, the so-called problem of induction, these are false problems. These are phony problems. You don't have to define or give a source for these things any more than you have to give a source for digestion. Digestion is one of the ways that a stomach functions. First, you have to have a stomach, and the stomach functions, and one of the functions of the stomach is to digest food. Digestion is not a thing out there that has to be justified for its existence. Digestion is just one of the things that a stomach does. Logic and reason and induction are not things that have to be justified or sources given for them. They are one or some of the ways that an organ called the brain functions properly. Even the simplest animals, at a simple level, at a primitive level, are using logic and reason. As data comes into their brains, they process that data and they make decisions based upon, you know, they're not even conscious of it. We more conscious animals will sometimes formalize the logic and pretend like it's a big subject, and it is, you know, to formalize the steps of how you would go from A to B to C, and to specify that A is not A, you know, the excluded middle, all those things, which is fun to do. But logic and induction and reasoning itself don't have to be justified. They don't even have to be presupposed. They are not things that you presuppose. You don't presuppose digestion. Digestion is the way the stomach works. So Paul is asking a non-question when he demands that we atheists somehow have to justify our presuppositions. In my book, I did not say that logic is a presupposition that atheists make.
Time.
What I did say was that when we're going to solve an argument using logic, we have to first examine the underlying assumptions. A logic itself is
right.
not one
Dan,
of those
right, Dan, time.
How, what's that?
Time.
Oh, time is up?
Yeah.
Well,
all
I
right.
think I basically said it all right there. Thank
okay.
you.
All right. Okay, Paul.
Yes,
2 minutes for your
time?
Rebuttal.
I was under. This is cross examination time, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
So who's doing what here?
On the
Paul
schedule,
is,
it
Paul
says
gonna...
I have 10 minutes cross.
Yes.
Okay. Dan, in your debate with Michael Butler, you said the laws of logic were the way a critical mind works. It sounds like you said that tonight. Do you still hold this view?
Well. Yeah, but not only critical minds. Other minds that are non-critical can also use the laws of logic, yeah. But yes, of course.
Okay. What is a critical mind?
It is a mind that does not simply accept the truth value of a statement unconditionally. It's a mind that steps back and says, wait a minute. Let me first examine whether this is true or not. A critical mind is negative, but that can be a double negative. You know, it can be a positive thing. A critical mind says, before I take someone's word for something, before I take a statement at face value, I would like to check out to see if the sky is actually blue or if my politician has a good character.
Okay, so it's a logical mind. It's a mind that thinks logically and rationally.
So, well, that's a tautology.
Yes, so logic is what a logical mind does. So you were
logic
giving us a tautology.
Logic is what a mind does.
What are minds?
Well, minds are calculating computational organs of an organism that processes impulses and data and perceptions from the outside world and makes decisions based upon those perceptions.
Okay. On page 63 of Losing Faith in Faith, you said that your mind does not need external guidelines. So there are no external laws of rationality that your mind must form to, correct? The laws are in your own mind, correct?
Yeah, I mean a mind functions. It's just like asking, is there an external digestion to the stomach?
Okay, so
digestion is the function of.
I don't
have
time for a rebuttal on that, Mr. Barker. My mind tells me that God exists, and yours tells you that He doesn't. Whose mind is working logically, and how do we know this?
My mind does not tell me that it doesn't. I don't obey my mind. When I use principles of reasoning, I come to the conclusion that it is more likely that God does not exist than that He does.
And you used your mind to come to that conclusion. I used my mind to come to the conclusion that He does exist. Which mind is working logically, and how do we know?
Well, mind is and yours is not. And we know it because when we check the statements that you make as a Christian, we check them against reality to the best of our knowledge. We find that they do not check against reality. They don't fulfill the test. In order for a statement to be true, as I said earlier, that has to have some reference in it. So when you make statements in your mind, for example, when your Christian worldview says there's such a thing as a talking snake, but we know that it is highly unlikely that snakes talk. We've never seen it happen. By induction, we know that snakes do not talk. And yet you, I assume you're a Calvinist Bible believer, you have to assume something that is non-inductive.
Okay.
You have to make...
Dan...
In other words, you are breaking the rules of logic.
Those are, first off, talking snakes aren't illogical. They might be physically impossible or something given your worldview, but it's not violating a law of logic. I was speaking of logic.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Dan,
in order for
talking snakes
to talk,
do not violate any law of logic.
Mechanism.
Which law of logic do talking snakes violate?
The whole definition of talk, what it means to talk, to produce sound waves in the air that are perceived by another ear that makes some kind of semantical sense. Snakes are not built to do that.
Okay, logic, so it's physically impossible. It's not logically.
You cannot have something that talks without the machinery to talk.
Okay, Dan, can the laws of logic, like the law of non-contradiction, for example, be falsified?
That's a non-question. It's only statements that can be falsified. Logic itself is not one of those statements. It's only a statement that is veridical that can be true or false. And so you're asking a non-question. The laws of logic are not statements.
Here's a statement. A can never be non-A. That's a statement. Can you falsify that statement?
Well, if A was ever A...
So you could falsify the law of non-contradiction. Okay, are you a realist about the laws of logic? That is, do you believe that they exist?
No, they don't exist.
They don't exist. Okay. if the laws are physical, the laws of logic are something that reside in your mind, they don't exist, or do they exist in your mind?
They're not things, as I said earlier. It'd be like asking, does digestion exist in the stomach?
Okay.
It's not a thing, it's a function.
Are you familiar with the problem of induction?
Yes, I am.
What is your secular answer for how you would resolve the problem of induction?
By saying that the conclusions that we derive from induction are tentative, weak conclusions. They are much weaker than deductive conclusions. And the conclusions that we draw from induction are useful, but not necessarily true. You can have an inductive conclusion that is false. And in fact, science has repeatedly come up with inductive conclusions that have turned out to be false. So I do not pretend that a conclusion based on induction...
Right, but how do you justify the problem of
fact.
Induction? You said you're familiar with the problem of induction. How do you justify? What's your secular answer? Was it that it works?
Well, I just told you it works enough. It doesn't work perfectly.
Okay.
It is useful. It works.
Is
you
it?
Know, that's how we know that snakes don't talk. We've never seen a snake that doesn't talk. But if we do find a snake that talks, if we do find one in reality, then that tentative law by induction would have to go. We would have to adjust our thinking.
No.
Induction is not a very... Yeah, I mean, it's useful, but it's not a very important logical principle. It's useful...
Okay, well, I don't have any more time for rebuttal on that one. Dan, is it morally wrong to eat broccoli for enjoyment?
Is it morally wrong
to eat broccoli for enjoyment?
If there's no harm caused from it, then no.
Okay, Dan, is it morally wrong to eat a person for enjoyment?
Yes, it is, because there's harm that results.
Okay, Dan, on page 31 of Maybe Right, Maybe Wrong, you said we should never try to hurt another living person or thing. On page 26, you said of the same book, humans are part of nature and are not better than nature, and that since we are part of nature, we should respect all of nature, not just humans. So my question is, given that, why is it okay to eat part of nature for enjoyment and not another part?
Because the harm from eating broccoli is not really a harm at all. The broccoli's going to die and wither pretty soon, and the harm from eating a human being is a real human value harm. You're not serious about that question. You're being...
No, I am. You said nothing is more... No parts of nature are more important, and we shouldn't try to hurt any part of nature. So that's a part of nature, and it sounds like you're saying humans are more important. I quoted you on page 26 saying humans are part of and not better than nature, but on page 8 you claim nothing is more important than human beings. How would you resolve this?
Well, human beings, you know, to a rat, nothing's more important than a rat. A rat values its existence and its family. And as parents who have children, whether they're genetic or adopted, we assign value to ourselves by nature, by our survival instincts, to a greater degree than we do to the rest of the world, than we do, let's say, to a piece of broccoli. Broccoli is valuable, but we evolved to eat it, and other animals evolved to eat us. So relative to me as a human being, of course, I value my own daughter.
So there are things more important than... So nature isn't totally isn't all equal, and there aren't anything one more important than the other.
Well, in the cosmic sense, yes, but in my own personal sense as a human being with feelings... for my loved ones. Of course, I attach more value to those for whom I am more responsible.
Okay, thank you. And since you said in your book you were familiar with the Bible, then who's, according to Christian teaching, whose glory is more important according to Christian teaching, God's or man's?
According to Christian teaching, well, God's glory is more important.
Dan, are humans considered innocent, or are they considered violators of God's law according to Christian teaching?
According to Christian teaching, they are violators of God's law, and that's biblical teaching.
Dan, you can rebut on your rebuttal period. Dan, according to Christian teaching, when God punishes sinners, is he doing this unjustly, according to Christian teaching?
According to Christian teaching?
Yes.
No, but according to my thinking, yes.
Right, I know, but according to Christian thinking, he's not. Okay, Dan, when did I say that presupposing Christianity is what makes it true?
1 minute.
Well, your opening statement basically said that we were having a debate between opposing presuppositions. So,
correct. When did I say, though, in my opening that presupposing it makes it true?
Presupposing it.
Did I say presupposing it makes it true?
I think you did. If you didn't, then correct me on that.
Well, I didn't say it, and we have the transcript. It's not. I have it written out here. There's nothing I said. Dan, for truth comes in degrees. What degree is what degree truth is atheism? 49% or 51%?
Well, I would say atheism is probably up like 95, 96, 97,
okay.
For a
statement to be true, it has to have a referent in reality. When you make the claim that Dan Barker is morally courageous, what is the referent in reality of the predicate of that statement?
Well, Dan Barker is a human being. I'm a real person.
Right. That's the non-linguistic entity. Dan Barker is the reference for the subject.
It's Dan's turn now to go ahead and lead across.
And courage and morality are actions. They're not things. And moral decisions are based on actions. Not, you know, it's not a thing.
Okay.
If I were burning you, we would say that's causing harm. Therefore, I'm not moral. So just to make something clear here, Paul, do you believe that a snake spoke human language?
Yes.
Yes, you do. So then do you believe that induction is a useful logical tool?
Yes.
You do. Do you agree that by using induction, we have to conclude that snakes do not talk?
Well, no, you yourself said if we have evidence that a snake talked, then that would falsify that position. So you're just begging the question against the Bible, assuming that it's false that the snake talked.
So if any book makes any statement that contradicts induction, we must consider that statement as evidence that contradicts induction?
No, and that's a false inference from what I said.
Well, what other evidence do you have besides the story in the third chapter of Genesis that a snake can speak human language?
No other evidence.
No other evidence, but a story. Words on a page, basically, is your only evidence.
Well, according to my worldview, that would be God's word on a page, and God can never lie. So if you're assuming that it's not God's word, again, you're begging the question and assuming that it's false, which is the point at hand.
So when you stack up the millions or billions of examples of snakes that we've seen that do not speak in real life against a story that says that a snake spoke human language, when you stack those two side by side, can you fault us skeptics for going with the principle of induction, as imperfect as it is, over your one little story that many of us are convinced is just a story? Can you fault us for that?
Yes, because again, Mr. Barker, according to you, if you have a counterexample to what was an inductive generalization, and you have a counterexample which is contrary to that, that would falsify it. So you're still assuming that the biblical narrative is wrong there, and that's begging the question. Furthermore, I would fault you because you cannot even account for the inductive process.
I just told you that I could.
I'll get to that in my rebuttal.
Let me tell you a true story. As I was walking home from work today to get here in time to do this interview, this brown cat walked up to me and spoke to me in perfect Spanish and said, "Allah es el único Dios verdadero." I was surprised. Mm-hmm. But that really happened, Paul. This is a true story. Do you believe that?
Do I believe that?
Yes.
No.
Why don't you believe that? I just told you a story.
Well, because I think that you're lying,
why
and
you
I think
just,
that the Bible
why do you
isn't.
Just that's my story.
I don't believe it because I think you're lying.
Why do you think that? You're free to call me a liar, but I'm not free to think the same thing of the Bible.
I didn't say you were not free to think that, but I pointed out that the epistemological point of the matter is the question at issue is if the Bible is true, that is a counterexample. So that's where
then tell me why you think I'm lying. Exactly why do you think I'm lying about that story?
Because I think contrary, based upon an inductive generalization, I don't think that cats speak or that a cat spoke to you. And that cat speak, but I believe that God could make it, make that happen if he were to.
Well, then why don't you believe that God could have made this happen?
Well, because I believe that those miracles have ceased, and I think that they have redemptive and revelational character to context to them, and so there was no revelational context.
Do you even know what that cat said to me?
He probably said, "Hey Dan, how's the LSD?"
Well, that's what I think about this story in Genesis.
They didn't have LSD back then, though, Dan.
Well, they had some kind of mushrooms or something else then. But don't you see how you're playing the exact same game with my story that I would play with your story?
Well, Dan, if your position was true, though,
better than mine.
If the cat did talk, if that is true, then that would falsify the claim that cats can't talk, wouldn't it?
Exactly.
Right. And so if the story in Genesis, all you asked me was, how can you believe that snakes talk, given that all the examples we have of them are that they don't talk? And I said, well, according to you, if we do have a claim that snakes can talk, which we do in the Bible, then that would falsify it, even according to you, if the story is correct. And again, that brings us back to what we're debating tonight, is whether or not those passages are true. And you said that epistemology must even be addressed before biblical criticism. And so you'd have to even... You have to bring up your account and justification
exactly.
Even for induction.
And you now have an evidence that cats talk. I just gave you a story that cats talk, and yet you immediately rejected it. You immediately, based on something external to the story, based on not even knowing what, you weren't even there, you immediately rejected that story based on a solid principle of induction. And I praise you for that. Mm-hmm. I think that was a smart thing for you to do, to be critical, to be skeptical, to apply your mind to statements that you don't think are true for logical reasons. And that's exactly what I'm doing. We both share the same epistemology here, Paul.
I understand that if you don't believe that it's true, then you would of course think, if you don't take Genesis chapter 3 as true, you would of course think that there is no problem, that there's a problem mentioning a talking snake. But if Genesis 3 is true, then there is a problem. And again, that brings us back to what we're debating tonight. So all you're doing is begging the question against Christian theism.
Well, I have other reasons for doubting that the story is true. There are many good reasons for showing how that myth evolved from other myths and how the myth...
Again, that would beg the question itself. Because according to my worldview, that's the very first two people that existed and the very first religion was Christianity. So to say it evolved from myths assumes and presupposes that Christianity wasn't the first religion and therefore assumes the falsity of the biblical account and therefore begs the question again against my worldview.
Well, if you're going to throw out all of history, we know that Christianity was not the first religion. We do know there were pre-existing religions.
Well, if you throw out the Bible, Dan, if you throw out the Bible,
we know that we know that the Israelites borrowed from other pagan traditions. We know that the Book of Genesis was pasted together and created and swapped and borrowed and contradicted each other. We know that from using these very principles of logic that you value. We know that Bible is not a dependable, reliable witness to most of the facts that happened back then.
Well, I don't think you have a picture of that in your mind. And
yes,
you
I
said
do.
Knowledge is a picture in your mind or an image in your mind.
Well,
and so I'd like to know what it looks like,
what
the image or picture looks like that says that they borrowed from other religions, if you could draw that picture.
Yes, I can. I can show you artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
Stelae with inscriptions that were from periods of time that predated the Israelites' occupation of that area.
But that's not what the question is about. The Israelites are relaying, Moses is telling a story of what happened before all of that. So all you're doing is assuming that Moses is lying. You're assuming
that,
so you're begging the question.
No, we have plenty of other good reasons.
I admit it was written later than the other documents, or that you can find earlier written manuscripts. That's not what I'm disputing. What I'm disputing is the claim that those, just because they were written earlier, means that necessarily implies that they borrowed from them. If the story of Genesis is true, then they are then Adam and Eve were the first two people. And
I must interject here. Don't forget, this is actually Dan's turn across, and it seems like it's turning more into an argument back and forth.
I was just giving an answer back.
Well, no, this is okay with me, Rich.
It's fine with you? Okay, just making sure. Okay.
No, I like Paul. I like us going at it like this. This is just...
Well, thank you.
You know, this is fun here. Are we done with the cross?
If you're fine with it. You have 2 more minutes to continue, Dan, if you have any more.
Well, morality was a question. I want to ask you a question, Paul. Do you think John Calvin was a good man?
A good man? No. When he was viewed as being clothed in the righteousness of Christ, and God looked at him upon the work, finished life and work and death of Jesus Christ, God viewed him as being good because it was Christ's righteousness. But no, according to Calvinism, if you're familiar with that, we believe in total depravity.
So Calvin was a depraved man, basically. You think his actions were good?
He probably had some good actions and some bad actions, just like everyone does.
And he wrote his Institutes, basically. Do you think we should admire the book of a man who brutally murdered one of his friends by burning him at the stake, tying his book to his body, destroying every one of his good friend's writings? Do you think we should admire a man who handled earthly justice with physical, bloodthirsty violence? Should we respect a man like John Calvin?
Well, there's much debate about him and Sir Rivetus, but Dan, in your book, Losing Faith in Faith, you say that when people attack, use ad hominem arguments, that's a sign that they are not confident in their position. And now you're engaging on an ad hominem argument.
I'm not attacking you.
You're attacking John Calvin, the man.
What your idea of morality is. Whom would you call a good man? I'm not attacking you.
You asked me if it was good that he's burning.
This is a perfect segue. Excuse me. Yeah, we're going to switch over this time. Go ahead, Paul. You can lead.
Is this my rebuttal time?
Well, I have a rebuttal, yes.
Okay. Yep. By way of rebuttal, I basically like to point out, Dan brought up the free will and omniscience argument that he calls Fang. The problems with this argument are multiply. Briefly, it assumes a libertarian view of God, which I deny. It further assumes God is in time, and his choices are rather than his choices being made timelessly. Therefore, it begs the question against my worldview on those two scores. Moreover, Mr. Barker does not think man has libertarian freedom. Indeed, on Gene Cook's show on Unchained Radio, he told us all that man isn't free. And all of our choices are made certain and determined by the laws of physics. Therefore, Mr. Barker is not a person, according to his own argument. But if Mr. Barker wants to escape this critique and says, since he acts free and is uncertain about the future, then 3 points should suffice to rebut this claim. It should be granted that it's theoretically possible, given physicalism, to find out in advance how we'll respond to certain situations. Indeed, many physicalists are committed to this project. If they succeed, will Mr. Barker say that at that point, persons cease to exist? Point two, infants do not, quote, act as if they were free, unquote. Therefore, are infants not persons? Point number three, if Dan were to, it's theoretically possible to conceive of, as a thought experiment, time travel, if Dan were able to go back in time and make his choice again, but this time he knew it was certain and he knew the choice that he would make because he had already made it, would Dan consider himself not a person then? Secondly, by way of rebuttal, Dan says concepts, universals and such, exist in physical brains, and exist in minds which are in physical brains. There's many problems. One, concepts are not physical, and so it does no good for physicalists to appeal to concepts. Two, this view fails to say why an object has the properties it has. A realist will argue that the reason a ball is red is because it has the property redness. It's not red because we call it red. So this does not solve the problem, which is why is it appropriate to ascribe redness rather than blueness to a ball? Or take the contingency problem. There are properties that are necessary, such as 7 being an odd number. That's true in all possible worlds. But human minds are not necessary, and so the concept, being odd numbered, cannot exist in human minds. Take the temporality problem. That is, before humans existed, the sun was hot and bright. Thus, the property's hotness and brightness at least could not have existed in human mind. Otherwise, the sun was not hot and bright until the advent of human minds. 5. The many minds problem asks, whose mind is, say, redness a property of or exist in? Do we have Dan Barker redness, Paul Minotta redness, Gene Cook redness, Reggie Finley redness? No. Now, if Mr. Barker wants to hold that universals exist in a mind, and since there are, as proven, necessary, eternal, and singular concepts and universals, then it follows that there at least that at least concepts have existed in a necessary, eternal, and singular mind. Therefore, Mr. Barker must either abandon his conceptualism or his atheism. Which will it be? Dan Barker gave a functionalist account of the mind tonight. We could start here by mentioning atheist John Searle's comment that if you are tempted towards functionalism, I believe you do not need refutation, you need help. Here's why. Functionalism taken as cause-functional stance regarding the mind says all explanations of the mental must be given in physical, non-rational, non-purposive terms. Functionalism can account for qualia, or what it is like to, say, be in pain, intentionality, the mind's being about something, or norms of reason. Indeed, Mr. Barker cannot account for this debate given his functionalism. There is a certain feel to, quote-unquote, what it is like to be in a debate. Now, can a functionalist give a causal functional account for this? If not, then the state does not possess this qualitative feel cannot be a state of what it is like to be in a debate. Secondly, take intentionality. Mr. Barker thinks about his debate opponent, me. But what sense does it make to talk about one physical thing being about another physical thing? Lastly, we debate. There are norms of reason which tell us how we should reason or how, given our beliefs, we ought to behave. On the functionalist account, though, this seems problematic. Indeed, one could be a zombie, this is David Chalmers' objection, functioning just like Dan and I and therefore be said to have minds. Would anyone want to hear zombies debate? Other than in a horror flick, of course. Lastly, induction. There are also many problems with Mr. Barker's attempted resolution of the problem of induction. First, it's a pragmatic justification and not an epistemic one. He said it just works. Secondly, the question is, what justifies you proceeding upon the expectation that the future will resemble the past? To say it's worked in the past, and since it's worked in the past, I can assume with probability that it'll work in the future, is to beg the question. Lastly, even Mr. Barker himself thinks that his secular answer doesn't cut it. On Losing Faith and Faith, page 61, Mr. Barker relays a story by Bertrand Russell. Basically, the story says that in the town of Changsha, during a lunar eclipse, blind men would beat gongs to frighten the heavenly dog who was attempting to swallow the moon. This practice has worked for thousands of years. The point is, just because something works does not mean it's rational. So Dan Barker's basic justification for induction is basically beating a gong. Now, of course, within my worldview, I don't have these problems. The problem here is that one needs a worldview in terms of which his beliefs are made intelligible, and atheism isn't that worldview. Simply put, if one believes that all that exists are marbles, then non-marbles will not be allowed in his worldview. If his worldview appeals to a non-marble to make his view that all that exists are marbles, then he undercuts his worldview. And so when Mr. Barker appeals to things like logic, induction, ethics, concepts, and minds, he's using non-marbles in his marble worldview. Facts are interpreted within a worldview. Logic, to just say it doesn't exist, that applies the laws of logic to saying it doesn't exist. You're saying it does not exist. This was mentioned by Aristotle thousands of years ago. If one does not have a proper worldview, the facts remain unintelligible. Picture it like a joke. I could tell a joke and insert the punchline of another joke as the punchline for the joke I told. If I did so, the joke would not be funny. It wouldn't be intelligible. Within my worldview, universal, immaterial, and unchanging laws of logic are not an automatic problem. They exist in my worldview, whereas Dan said they don't. Indeed, how could something like recognizing modalities have had any survival value for our hunter-gatherer ancestors? On the Christian worldview, it's God's very nature to think in terms of necessary truths. Indeed, on the Christian worldview, God is necessary. Given our story, where we are made in the image of God, who wants us to know facts about himself and the world, we can account for why we would think in these terms. In our worldview, the laws of logic reflect God's thinking, and thus it would account for why we have universal, immaterial, and invariant laws of logic. Or take induction. Given our presuppositions, God has made the world orderly and governs it according to his sovereign plan. He has told us in his world that we can expect nature to be uniform. And since he is a covenant-keeping God, we can count on his promises. And we're in a similar situation with morality. If you want moral absolutes, if you want to just condemn people and say that was absolutely wrong, it's absolutely wrong to torture little girls for the fun of it, for the mere fun of it, which you're going to need if you want to objectively morality and non-arbitrarily condemn or praise God's or Gandhi's actions. You need objective standards. There are real or moral obligations, and only persons can obligate us. There are universal obligations obligated by the universal person, God. If you want to reject this, then it comes down to saying that while you like chocolate ice cream, some people like vanilla ice cream. And while you like to eat broccoli, some people like to eat other people. And that's it. Dan says you can't cause unnecessary harm. Unnecessary for what? For me to take his car, it might be necessary to beat him in the head. Now he might say, well, you shouldn't have taken my car then. It's necessary for me to satisfy my desires for Mr. Barker's car to take it. So he has no position on morality and nothing that is rational tonight. The Christian worldview provides the proper story and makes the facts intelligible. Mr. Barker's atheist worldview does not. He is internally inconsistent and therefore irrational. But Mr. Barker continues to use things like logic and induction and ethics. Thus, he's saying one thing but behaving another way. He shows that he sees the evidence of God's existence but then suppresses it. Therefore, I maintain that the atheist is agent irrational with his respect to his lack of belief, and his lack of belief is non-rational. Lastly, in regards to his evidentialism, if we need evidence for every single claim, well, first off, he goes, I don't need to give evidence for logic and induction. Well, then I don't need to give evidence for God. Furthermore, do you have evidence for that belief, that you need evidence for every belief? And then when you give me evidence, do you have evidence to back that evidence? And then when you give me new evidence, do you have evidence to back the new evidence? See, Dan's caught in an infinite regress. And if he attempts to use classical foundationalism, he'll be refuted by the likes of Alvin Plantinga, who asks, well, what basis do you have to believe your foundation? It's not a deliverance of reason, and it's not a basic belief. So Dan's evidentialism, his reason for not believing in God, is therefore refuted. Thank you.
All right. Dan, you have 2 minutes for your rebuttal.
Yeah, well, I think all of these words, I pretty much addressed them in my opening statement. A big mistake that Paul is making is to reify labels. The word logic, for example, he's reifying the word logic. He's making it into a thing. He's doing the same thing with morality, talking as if morality were some absolute thing. When I was very careful to define these words not as things, but as descriptions of the way a certain organ functions. And my good analogy is digestion. I don't think Paul believes that there is a huge cosmic capital D digestion out in the universe somewhere that has to be justified before we can talk about it. I mean, in some infinite regress of loop of justifying digestion, well, how do we know digestion? Does digestion digest? It's like asking, is logic logical? Those are stupid questions. You're asking one question in one logical sphere up to another logical sphere. Here's just one trivial example. He mentioned odd numbers and even numbers. We know that in the set of whole numbers, every even number is separated from its neighbor by a distance of 2, by absolute 2. By definition, that's what it means to be an even number. Well, by definition, even numbers have that property. And therefore, can we say that the set of even numbers, that whole set, is therefore separate from other sets of numbers by a distance of 2? That's a stupid question. It's taking the finding from one logical sphere, pulling it up by its bootstraps, and trying to pretend that it has some kind of meaning in a higher logical sphere of thinking. Well, of course you can get into infinite regresses. Well, then, is that set, are those two sets, a set which is separate from other sets by a distance of 2 sets? You get into these stupid questions, and if you think like Paul's thinking, those questions make sense to you. But in a non-theistic worldview, those questions are not even askable questions. It's like asking, what's further north than the North Pole? You say, well, that's not a question to ask. If you insist on asking it because you like the question so much, you're asking an unaskable question that doesn't have a sensible answer to it. And then you pretend that you've caught us in some kind of a self-contradictory loop, when in fact it is you who is making the mistake of reifying concepts. Morality is not a thing. Morality, according to my definition and my worldview, and by the way, my worldview goes way beyond atheism. Atheism is simply the absence of theism. As a human being, I embrace humanism and rationalism and feminism and social causes that are above and beyond and have nothing to do with atheism. I'm a positive, proactive human being for reasons other than what I believe or don't believe. But morality, as I define it and as I use it, and as I think most humanists use it, it's not an atheistic statement, it's a humanistic statement. It is the intention to act in ways that minimize harm. A person who intends to act in a way that minimizes real harm in the world is, by definition, a moral person. Even if you fail, if that was your intention, then you are called a moral person. You may not be fully informed. So to be truly moral, you should try to be as informed as possible. To be informed means to use the tools of reason to see if statements really are veridical or true or not. So obviously the operative word here is the word harm. That's what we mean by morality. Morality is not something out there with absolute standards. Morality is a real down-in-the-dirt, real-world exercise of determining, does this action result in more or less harm than other? And most of the time, or much of the time, there's no clear-cut answer. Sometimes it's muddy, it's gray, whereas Paul's worldview has everything in a black and white, cut and dry, absolutistic. Some actions are always right, some actions are always wrong. In the real world, all of us, Paul included, we are situational ethicists. We base our morality on the outcome. For example, a woman comes pounding on your door. She's bruised and bleeding, and she says her husband's trying to kill her. And so you bring her in the house, and you help her out. You care. You feel for her. You give her a place to stay. Later that evening, her husband comes banging on the door asking, "Do you know where my wife is?" A moral person would lie to that man. A moral person would say, "No, I don't." A moral person would not tell the truth to that man because there's no absolute rule that you should always tell the truth or never tell a lie. It depends on the situation. If Paul thinks that it's always wrong to tell a lie, I'm not second-guessing his morality, but if he thinks that telling lies are always wrong, then he would be in the danger of causing more harm to that woman than by telling a lie to him. So that's just one simple example. There are many examples in real life where moral dilemmas arise because we have a conflict of positive values. Excuse me. Free will. Yes, I am a determinist, but I'm more what you call a compatibilist. And no, compatibilism is not dead. I think the only reason we can get away with saying that we have free will is because we don't know the future. If we were like God and if we did know the future, then we would not have free will. We would not be personal beings. And in fact, in reality, we are not. In the end of the cosmos, it's not going to matter. You and I are like ants or rats or like pieces of broccoli, really, in the big picture. But relative to me as a human being who does happen to come packaged with these feelings and instincts, relative to me, my brain is assigning value to my species. Relative to me, there is no value to our species. We are not any better than the rest of nature. But from inside out, relative to me, from my mind, he does have value. I intend to act in ways that minimize harm to me and to my family, and to my friends, and to my neighborhood, and to the rest. And with that intention, you don't have to have that intention. There's no moral imperative in the cosmos. Nothing cares and nobody cares. But relative to us now, with that intention, I can be labeled a moral person. That's a lowercase m. It's not some big cosmic thing that's handed down, as if we human beings were too stupid to figure out something wrong with killing. Israelites hadn't told us they had the copyright on the Ten Commandments. My goodness, I mean, what a pessimistic view of human nature Christianity possesses, that we are just rotten and depraved, and people value by their faith, not by their actions. John Calvin was a horribly brutal man who needed to be denounced for his immoral evil act. Anyone who expects it all as a human being is morally bankrupt. And I would think Paul Minotta would feel the same way about John Calvin. His actions were despicable, and Of course, he was doing it in the name of God. And look what happens in history when you take God as your standard for morality rather than the simple humanistic principle of intending to act in ways that minimize harm. The Bible says that nature is uniform. I doubt it, Paul. All over the place, the uniformity of nature is violated in the Bible. And if God is the source of the laws of logic, you are implying that God could have made the laws of logic different from what they are. You are implying that God could have made A equal to not A. And the laws of logic they're not things. They're just the way that our brains function when we process data and perceptions that come into it. So, if the laws of logic are that absolute, and if God could not have changed them, then there's something higher than God. That applies with morality, too. If might makes right, if something is right or wrong simply because God decrees it, and that God doesn't have a standard outside of himself, of course, that's that old dilemma that theists have in trying to justify the morality of God. Well, then God's not moral either. He has no standards. It's just a whim, and he's just like a dictator who says, oh, I feel like creating humans. Oh, I feel like punishing people because my fragile ego was wounded because people did not pray to me and worship me and burn animals on an earthen mound, like it says in the Ten Commandments. So ultimately, even if Paul is right, even if we atheists are completely bankrupt in all of our reasoning and rationalizations, even if we are totally off the mark, you still cannot make a case, not even for the superiority of Christianity, but you can't even make a case for the truth values of Christianity. All you have is a story, a book written by primitive people. That's all you have is ink on a page, and then you have different versions of it. In fact, I bet Paul respects the King James Version. I'm not sure. I would have to ask him that.
1 minute.
And the King James Version, of course, is probably one of the worst versions you can use. It's the version that John Calvin used. For example, 1 John 5:7 has this declaration of the Trinity, which actually turns out to be an imposter. That verse does not belong in the Bible. Christians tampered with the Bible. They contradict each other. They make incoherent statements. 1 John 5:7 is not a part of the original document, and yet I used to preach it, and John Calvin used to preach that. John Calvin thought he was preaching the Word of God. He was deceived. And, maybe I'm deceived in some ways, and I'm sure Paul is deceived in some ways as well. Ultimately, then, since we don't have evidence for a God, and we don't have to justify induction or logic, it makes much more sense not to hold the belief in this fantastic being called a God.
All right, time. Okay, at this point, we're going to move to closing. Paul?
Okay. Basically, there's been no rebuttal to the arguments that I've given tonight against Dan Barker's position, and furthermore, in defense of my position. Dan brought up the incoherency argument of the free will argument. I responded and rebutted that argument and gave an argument to that and showed how it was assuming a false conception of God that I don't hold to. So he needed to address my argument tonight, not in a straw man. His other answer, which was a response, somewhat of his way of responding to my arguments, has been just to say, well, I just reified logic. Well, first off, I did not. A reification is something like this. When on page 93 of Losing Faith in Faith, Dan says, there are specific criteria that apply in a regular and universal manner through time, guiding us in determining what is true or false. That's reification. Dan's saying that there's some norms of reason out there guiding us. So that's reification. And furthermore, he's just begging the question against metaphysical realism, okay? Because the question if logic exists is, if according to one's ontology, if that's a member in one's ontology, then you can rightly say it exists and you wouldn't be reifying it. So only according to the position that says it doesn't exist, and then when I say it does exist, would I be reifying it? So he's begging the question against metaphysical realism. He says, I'm asking stupid questions. Well, what is Dan's standard of stupidness? What's his universal absolute standard by which he can determine which questions are stupid and not? He has none. It's all in his head, that he said. All these standards are in his mind. He told us in my cross-examination that he has no outside standard, just his mind. So just according to Dan's mind, I'm stupid. Well, according to my mind, his position's stupid. How do we judge between each other's mind? Then he tells us morality is just causing harm. You have to minimize harm. That it doesn't do you no good to stipulate that. Who cares? Hitler didn't buy Dan's morality. So what's Dan Barker going to come and just shake his finger at everyone and say, "Don't cause harm"? Now that's not putting forth an ethical theory. In reality, we're not persons. In reality, we're like broccoli. I mean, that's the atheist worldview. Dan just told us tonight that we're more like broccoli. he says, like, we can't figure out what's wrong, according to morality. But then on page 121 of Losing Faith in Faith, he says, there's something about human nature which makes us which makes most of us susceptible to error. So he has a rational-irrational dialectic. He again uses the ad hominem against John Calvin, as if I can't point to an atheist who did some big nasty things, supposing that John Calvin did these things. I can't point to an atheist who says and point out and say, ooh, look at the mean, nasty things he did. He says that my view implies logic could have been different. No, it doesn't. I believe the laws of logic reflect the way God thinks and his character. But notice this. Dan Barker used that as a critique. He said, since it implies that the laws of logic could have been different, then that was somehow a critique of my worldview. I've just avoided that. Now here's the turning of the tables. He says that's just the way our brains have functioned. The laws of logic are the ways our function. Well, we could have evolved differently. If the laws of logic are just the way our brains function, we could have evolved differently. And therefore, the laws of logic, according to what Dan just said, could have been different. So Dan has refuted himself if he thinks that's an argument against me. If not, then he has to drop his argument against me. He says, all I have is a story. Well, you know, it's hand-waving and just name-calling and saying all you have is a story is not a refutation. I mean, how does he know all I have is a story? We're just broccoli. Dan, the reason that your worldview is inconsistent and you cannot put together a rational worldview is because you've rejected the Lord of reason. You have turned your back on the Lord, Jesus Christ, and the only worldview that makes sense of rationality. You see, this is the intellectual challenge of the gospel, Mr. Barker, and you need to turn and repent and to the Lord Jesus Christ and ask him to forgive you of your sins and your violation of God's law in this universe. Otherwise, you're going to continue to see the effects of sin in this life, in your reasoning, and then pay for those effects in the life to come. And I do hope that you would turn and run towards Jesus Christ. He can save your intellect and your moral character. Thank you.
Okay. Again. Okay, well, Dan, here you go. Here's your closing. You have 5 minutes. And then, by the way, let me remind the listeners that we will take phone calls, and also I'll be looking in the chat rooms as well after Dan's closing, so make sure you get ready to dial in. Someone's been dialing for the past 90 minutes. My goodness. Okay. Go ahead, Dan, with the closing.
Well, thank you, Paul, for caring so much about me that you want me to think like you do and embrace Christianity. You have to know that I've already done that. I've already tried that. I've been there. I've done that. I've lived the Christian life for many years. I preached for 19 years. I know what you're saying. Of course, every Christian group is slightly different in its emphases, and you presuppositionalists have what I think most philosophers call quite a fringe position, pretending that attacking the basis of reason and induction somehow allow you the freedom to just embrace your presupposition because to your mind it seems to make more sense. But I do reject Jesus Christ. He is not my Lord. If he did exist, I would tell him to his face that if he created a hell, then he should go to hell. He's an immoral person by my standards of trying to avoid harm. Maybe my standards are wrong. Maybe most human beings are completely off bases and don't have a good standard for morality. But most of us do think it is wrong to own and beat slaves. Most of us who are mentally healthy do think that it causes more harm to castrate men than not. For example, when Jesus said there are some men that should be castrated. And on and on. When we look at the character of the teachings of this man Jesus, we just apply basic humanistic principles of morality. Right or wrong, these are the principles that I have embraced, that I think the world should have less harm in it and more understanding. Then I just probably reject your Jesus, a moral monster. He is not admiration. He's not worthy of respect. And if his father were alive, and if I met him face to face, I would tell him to go to hell. He created a place of torture, people who act in brutal ways. Well, then he should go there. You and I are better than that. We are higher than the people who wrote those primitive, brutal words of the Bible. We could come up with a better set, a more coherent way of thinking than that. So Yes, we are no different from broccoli in the cosmic sense. That's what I said. But you failed to understand that in the relative sense of our own existence as a human species, we do have value. And I was very careful to point that out. A lot doesn't matter what happens to me or a piece of broccoli. It won't. The sun's going to explode. We'll all be gone. No one's going to care. But right now, here, tentatively, we care. And that's what makes it precious, not because there's some cosmic value to it, because our hearts are beating right now on this planet, and we care about ourselves now. There's no ultimate value, but there is beautiful proximate value in our own lives, which is superior to Christianity, which Christianity often asks us to sacrifice the beauty of our own lives and teaches us a pessimistic view of human nature, that, as you said, that John Calvin was depraved. Humanists don't think that way. We don't think we're necessarily good either, but at least we're not depraved. And Hitler himself, he might have been mentally unhealthy. He might have been mentally ill. I would think he would qualify as a person who was not quite all there morally. He was one on the tail end of the bell curve of morality, of where you find the sociopaths and the psychopaths and the murderers. But most of us are better than that. Most of us value human life enough. And it's a good thing that there are more human beings who value life more than Hitler. We fought against him, denounced him, not on cosmic grounds, but we denounced him because Hitler caused unnecessary harm. That wasn't a hard thing to figure out. Hitler was free to think he was doing the right thing. He was free to do that. The rest of us are also free to denounce someone who causes unnecessary harm. And from our perspective as caring human beings, wanting to minimize harm in the world, we are free to say that what Hitler did was immoral. Cosmically, it won't matter. But to us, it does matter. This atheistic, humanistic worldview really cares about this world, not about flattering the ego of a slave master who wants to be worshipped and bowed down and adored. What if I treated my children like that? I created my kids by combining DNA with my wife. And what if I demanded that they bow down and worship me and tell me how great I was every single day, or else I wouldn't feed them, or I'd burn them in a hell? You would call me a morally bankrupt, brutal dictator, and that's what the God of the Bible is like. So I think the atheistic worldview is much more in tune with the real world because we value human life. The Christian worldview does not. The Christian worldview values God's life. God's glory is more important. Therefore, there's all sorts of examples of immorality which happened by following the Christian worldview. God asking Abraham to sacrifice his son.
Okay, that's it, Dan. I'm sorry, but that's...
The time is up now?
Yep, that's right.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, no problem. Okay, well, at this point, I would thank you guys again for appearing on the program to debate the issue of, in Paul's mind, what is rational, period, Christian theism or atheism. And at this point, what I'll do is go to either the phones in the chat room, so make sure I'll be looking at both rooms. So please make sure if you have any questions, you type those in red. The lines are now open. This is a number you can call in to 888-503-0802. Please make your questions short and quick, and do not debate the panelists. Okay, I would appreciate it. Okay, let's see here. Oh, the person just hung up here. Okay, I guess I'll take a question from... Let me scroll up here. Okay, German American says, and I guess this question is directed toward Paul, how can Christianity be more rational than atheism if Christianity, based on the literal interpretation of the Bible, isn't even rational within itself? Paul?
Hello, sorry about that.
That's okay.
I guess that's the question we're debating. He just basically said, how can it be rational because it's irrational? I mean, I don't... How would I respond? It's rational because, as I have argued tonight, it provides a worldview in terms of which those basic paradigms of rationality make sense in. That's basically, I don't see how that's any argument against Christianity to say, how is it rational when it talks about irrational things? That's called begging the question.
Okay.
No, it's not begging the question. It's a very good question. According to rationality, whatever its basis is, snakes do not talk. Donkeys do not talk. Seven-headed red dragons, tails of scorpions, do not speak. People do not walk on water unaided. Food does not magically fall from the sky. Disembodied hands don't float in the air and write words on the wall. the Nile River does not turn actual blood. According to rationality, according to induction, according to all that we know about how the world works, those claims are irrational claims. And you might want to assert them anyway on a presuppositional basis, but the Bible makes claims that are simply not rational. If cattle will stare at a striped pole, for example, then they will become fertile, as the Bible says. And on and on and on. You find all sorts of non-scientific, primitive, now disproved ideas that the primitive peoples of the Bible used to believe. There might be some truth in the Bible, but there are certainly a lot of things in the Bible that are irrational. And based on rational grounds that Paul tends to revere, those stories ought to be rejected.
All right, Dan. Okay, let's go ahead and take this call here. And let's try to keep it short, guys, if we can, okay? All right, let's take this call. I think the line's open. Hello, you're...
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this question is for Mr. Barker.
Sure.
Mr. Barker, you said that logic is how a rational mind functions. But how do you know when a mind is functioning rationally? How do you check that out?
Good question. Thank you.
Well, yeah, that is a good question. And that's a question that a lot of philosophers are dealing with now. But I think, you know, the key word is health. And an organism is healthy if it survives in a way that causes, I think, a minimal amount of harm in the world. So there are probably some yardsticks that we could use. I mean, if a person says, rationally, I'm going to stick my hand in the fire and it won't burn me, and we see that person stick their hand in the fire and it does burn them, we would call that an unhealthy action. And therefore, we would say that person is not mentally healthy. Their logic is not functioning right. Brains can malfunction. Brains can go wrong to a great degree or sometimes to a lesser degree. You can have schizophrenics or you can have schizotypical people. You can have all sorts of gradations in the middle. And I think most of us, including me and Paul and most of our listeners, are pretty much healthy in most of our lives. We fall somewhere in the middle of that bell curve of mental health. But, you look at behavior, you look at how a person acts, and if a person is acting in self-destructive ways based on a logical conclusion, we can say, well, that's not logical. And if you ask them to formalize it and spell it out to you, you might be able to point out the actual logical fallacies. You might be able to catch them in a contradiction, for example, or in a non sequitur.
Okay. All right, Paul?
Yes, that was a good question as well, and it's one of the ones I asked in my cross-examination, Dan. It appears that you didn't quite understand it. Basically, what the question is saying is if rationality, if laws of logic are something in your mind, then how do you check them? And then what you mentioned, you brought up, well, there's this yardstick. See, what you've done now is transcended them outside the mind as something which both the minds could be checked against. So what that's doing is basically you're going against your position that it's just something inside the mind. And then you started basically talking about harm, which isn't really isn't on the subject of the laws of logic. And so what we have here, basically, Dan's trying to give an account for it, but you see, he wasn't acting according to his functionalist theory of mind, his physicalism. What he needs to do is give an account for this sort of stuff in physical causal terms, non-rational terms. Things like rocks and laws of physics are non-rational, okay? And so Dan needs to give an account for them according to those lines, non-purposive and non-rational terms. And you can't appeal, he can't give an account for them that's at the base is something that's rational. He can't give a basic account that's rational because he's...
Right. Okay. Let's go ahead and take this. We have another call here. Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
Yeah, I have a question for Dan.
Okay.
Okay, Dan.
Can you speak up? You're really faint. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Dan, I'm just curious. When it comes to morality, it seems like you've kind of made harm and the avoidance of harm your absolute. And I'm just wondering, upon what basis, upon what rational basis, is harm itself even a bad thing?
Great question.
Because harm threatens our very existence. We are evolved organisms, and sticking your hand in the fire, jumping off a cliff, drowning in water, or you name it, there are many things that will actually threaten our survival as individuals and as a species. And this is what we call harm. It might hurt, or it might not even hurt at all, but it can still be harmful. I mean, you might die from You know, odorless gas with no pain, it's that we would still call it harm because it threatens our survival. So I think generally, harm would be defined as something which threatens our ability to continue to exist or to reproduce as a species, or compromises it in some way. And I guess some people would even say happiness could be harmed. I don't know about that. There's so many philosophies. But I would like to point out that I just represent one atheistic point of view. Just like there are different Christian points of view, I do not speak for all atheists on morality. There are some atheists who are moral realists, and I am not one of them.
All right, Paul?
Yeah, basically the response to that is that it causes harm and that's bad for our society. The response to that, it's pretty technical. It goes like this. Who cares? Okay? Who cares? We're pieces of broccoli, okay? And the cosmic universe really doesn't care about us at all. And we don't really know if we're right because humans make mistakes all the time. And so basically Dan has this opinion that he's come up with that he's admitted, maybe I could be totally off, that says, well, causing harm is bad. It hurts people and it hurts the species. It's not defining harm. I mean, what is it to harm someone? Okay, can you? Some people might train for the Olympics, and doing that, they're being caused harm. So this would have to be fleshed out a bit. And given evolution, that certainly makes no sense to given the evolutionary hypothesis and survival of the fittest. And animals do sort harm other animals all sorts all the time. And so why should we listen to Dan? Why should someone else listen to Dan saying, well, you shouldn't harm people because then we can't survive? No, I can just make myself stronger so Dan can't harm me, and then I'll harm Dan because he has the car that I want. So that it makes no sense to stipulate that harm is wrong just to go ahead and tell everyone, to tell a bunch of people of pieces of broccoli that they shouldn't harm other people, other pieces of broccoli.
Okay. All right, got a question from the chat room now. I'm getting a lot of questions geared toward Dan's list, geared some here toward Paul here. It looks like Hook Flash in the IRC room is asking, Paul, if you can justify logic, reason, and morality by presupposing the existence of God, then why can't the atheist just presuppose the justification of logic, reason, and morality?
Well, basically, first off, that option isn't open to Dan tonight because he told us that you can't just presuppose things. Presupposing doesn't make it true. So we would have to note that doesn't make Dan's position rational. Secondly, presuppositions in the Vantillian scheme aren't just a bunch of arbitrary presuppositions. You don't just arbitrarily choose your presuppositions like you do hats. So the problem here is that you have to put it together into a worldview. And you see, as an atheist, I would argue, and as Dan's mentioned, there's different views out there, so I'd have to see the particular atheist's views. What we have here is someone and that needs to put a worldview together. So if you're going to say, well, I can just presuppose the laws of logic, and I also have a view that everything that exists is material. Okay, well, the laws of logic are not material in nature. So what you're saying on one hand is, well, I say that everything that exists are marbles, and then I'll presuppose that some non-marble entities exist. Okay, so that's the problem, is that your worldview undermines these presuppositions, and furthermore, an atheist might want to go ahead and do that and take it on faith.
All right, Dan?
Well, see, Paul is exactly illustrating the problem that his mind is unable to grasp, and I keep saying this over and over again. You keep thinking that something like logic is a thing that has to be justified. You need your consciousness raised here. In an earlier answer, you said that I have to justify the rational in terms of the non-rational. That would be like asking, I have to justify the digestional in the terms of the non-digestional. You know, you're building sphere upon sphere, pretending that a word within one logical context has some relevance or meaning in a higher sphere. Logic is a function. It is a computational function of a working brain. If there were no minds or no organisms with minds or something like minds in them, then there would be no logic. It is only when brains are thinking, it's only when a brain is working that we have to make these computations. Is that an enemy or a friend? Is that something to mate with or something to run from? Is that food or is that poison? You know, we make these computations, we make value judgments, not because there is a capital V value out in the world, but because relative to ourselves. And you missed my point earlier about whether we're broccoli or not. I agree, cosmically, we are just broccoli. But inside out, relative to ourselves, relative to a piece of broccoli, broccoli is valuable. relative to me, a human being, human beings are valuable, and we have value, and we have instincts, and we have a brain that has evolved to process that value. So you're comparing apples
and
oranges, Paul.
Yeah, okay, let's move on to the next question. Another question to Paul here, I believe it's from Lucretius in the stick cam room, is asking, why should we even listen to God, Paul?
Well, because he is the ultimate authority. He's the creator of everything, and you are his creature. Every word that he utters is true. Everything that he does is always right. He always knows what's best for us. He knows us better than we know ourselves. He knows how to live our lives better than we know how to live them. The purpose and chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. So given the Christian worldview, we should go ahead and listen to God. Given a non-Christian worldview, according to your views of God, the false views of God that you have, well, then I can understand why you wouldn't want to listen to, why you wouldn't listen to God. But given our worldview, you should listen to God, and those are very rational reasons for why you should. And even assuming that God exists, given when you say, well, God exists, and I'll assume that he exists, why should we listen to him? Well, then assume the whole story. Assume that it's a being who knows everything, knows you better than you know yourself, knows how to, how you should live your life, and what is best for you. Then, of course, we should all say, yeah, we should listen to that kind of being if he existed.
Dan?
Well, all of those things you say about God, I mean, how do you know that's true? I mean, you claim to know that's true because a book told you that that's true. And it's only because you are choosing to believe the words of those primitive writers who told you that that is true. But when you examine those words in the context of history, in the context of science, in the context of biblical criticism, comparative mythology, and on and on, when you use those tools to examine those words which inform you about the character of this God, we find out that those words fall apart. They are not dependable. They are internally contradictory. They go against what we know to be scientific. They go against what we as a society deem to be moral. If there is a God, if your God does exist, I mean, if that God really is there, well, who was he to say? Because he's powerful? Because he's going to punish me if I disagree with him? Who was he to say that I don't have the freedom to look him in the face and tell him to go to hell? Just because he created me, that makes him morally superior to me? My aim in life is to glorify this monster? Is it my child's aim in life to glorify me, the father? No, it isn't. I would hope that my children would disagree with me if I mistreat them in some way. Paul's worldview is a morally bankrupt. It's a slave master, a slave to a slave master mentality.
Oh, okay.
It is not morality, and it is
not logic. All right, Dan. Okay, let's... We have 3 minutes left here, so let's try to squeeze this in. I have one final call. Let's see if we can give you guys both a minute each. I'll be looking at it very closely. And if we happen to get cut off at the Free Thought Media feed, I apologize. Just jump on over to Stick Cam if you need to really quickly, just for the final couple of seconds. Okay, let's take this call here. Hello?
Hey, hi. Hi, Reg. My name is Chris. I just wanted to make some points about logic that I've already...
Can you speak up?
I'm sorry. First of all, logic is not descriptive. It's a methodological statement. Therefore, logic itself doesn't need to be subjected to proof. It's the standard by which proofs are possible. Logic is based on either axioms or it's based on rules created in the system. So the basic point that Paul's making is an error. Second, he made a claim that there's no epistemic justification for induction. That's false. If you go back to the 1700s, you have Bayes' theorem, and later logicians added to that, and they have given us what we call today axiomized. Well, I just want to make the point that induction is based on a due system, so it has an epistemic support.
All right, this isn't really a question, but Paul, go ahead and respond. Thank you for the call.
Okay. Basically, I never said that the laws of logic were descriptive. I actually said that they were normative, so I don't see how that's a refutation of my position. It's not, since it attacked a straw man. And I also asked how we can account for it given our worldview. Okay, if you have a worldview, again, that says all that exists are marbles, all that exists are matter, you can't say that some non-marble entity exists, just like Dan admitted tonight. He said logic doesn't exist. And I never said that there's no epistemic justification for induction. I think I have one. What I said is Dan's pragmatic justification was not an epistemic justification, but a pragmatic one. That's what I said. So the, I guess... I wasn't clear enough in my point on that.
Okay. All right, Dan?
If there is a God, it would be an amazing thing to know. This God would be made up of something. This God has a functional mind that works in an orderly, logical way. It makes decisions. It has moral judgments. It has desires to create. It has angers. It has emotions. If there is a God, the mind of this God is an amazing, complicated, functionally impressive thing. Whatever it's made out of, whatever it's composed of, and it can't be a simple thing. It has to have discrete parts within it so that it can have decision-making, antecedents before you make one decision to another. It has to have some kind of functional computer brain functioning to it. Whatever it's made out of, you could call those things marbles, too. Whatever it is, you call them spiritual marbles, if you wish. If it somehow denigrates my worldview to think that all we live in is a world of functioning marbles, well, then the same argument applies to this God itself, who has no external justification for its intelligence, its logic, or its moral principles. It just is allowed to exist on its own. And in the atheistic worldview, we think the universe is allowed to exist on its own and relative to us as human beings with functioning brains that have to make value judgments. We can say that our life is beautiful, that our lives have purpose and meaning and morality. And we can say that we have some ways of deciding whether to label someone as moral or immoral, logical or illogical.
Well, all right. Well, hey, thank you both gentlemen for appearing on the program to talk about which is more rational. I really appreciate it, Paul, Dan. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot, Reggie. This is always fun.
No doubt. Have a good night.
Thank you, Dan.
Bye, Paul.
Bye.
Bye-bye.